Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell is out this week, but don't worry. I, your fearless captain, will take you down the path of tech news. We start with Scott Hanselman of Microsoft to talk about how Microsoft, well, frankly, Scott, worked to open source 3D Movie Maker, an application from yesteryear that still has a huge fan base of folks who want to make 3D movies on their computers. Then Misha Rykov of the Mozilla Foundation stops by to talk about the latest addition to Mozilla Foundation's Privacy Not Included guide. It's all about mental health apps and their privacy policies and how you can keep yourself safe online. Then I do the rundown of Google I.O., the biggest announcements from the event, and round things out with a sort of kind of reveal from Mark Zuckerberg for Meta's next mixed reality headset. Stay tuned.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 234, recorded Thursday, May 12th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Nureva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components, installation can take days, and well, you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex, expensive. But Nureva Audio is easy to install and manage, no technicians required, and you get true full room coverage. That's easy economical. Learn more at Nureva.com. Also brought to you by NetFoundry. Reinvent the network and eliminate the WAN by decoupling security from infrastructure to protect our applications and data with open source zero trust. Grab your free swag and free tier now by going to netfoundry.io/twit. And by New Relic. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does, and you can get access to the whole New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free per month forever. No credit card required. Sign up at newrelic.com/TNW. Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I say we, but this week I just mean me. Jason Howell is not here with us this week. He should hopefully be back next week. But until then, you're stuck with me, Micah Sargent. And I am honestly ready to get this show rolling because we've got some great conversations today. Up first, we are going to talk about open source software and open source software that has been made open source by someone who I consider some sort of, it's like the joy of the tooth fairy for youths mixed with the mystery of the Easter bunny, all wrapped up in internet memes, Beyonce love, which I adore, and just delightfulness in general. Joining us today is Scott Hanselman. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. That was a lovely introduction for a fellow Beyonce stan. Thank you for that.
Indeed. So I have to say, I was really pumped. A while back, I follow this developer, Foon, on Twitter. And they had tweeted about Microsoft 3D Movie Maker. And we're kind of looking into the application and realizing that, of course, this software made by Microsoft was not an open source application. And so we're going to talk about that in a moment. But for folks who maybe weren't around at the time or who have never heard of it, could you start by telling us about Microsoft 3D Movie Maker? What is it? When was it created? And what version of Windows did you have to run it?
Yeah, so 3D Movie Maker was a kids program. It was made around 1995, and it was part of the Microsoft Home series of products. And there was a thing called the Microsoft Kids subsidiary within Microsoft Home. And in 1995, this program came out and allowed kids to make kind of like small films, almost like vines, small, you know, 5 to 8 frames a second. These were not super high res. This was not a high res 4K time. You know, and you had pre-rendered 3D characters. So you see here, we have this little gentleman who lives in a 3D space, and you'd get the different models that you could start with, and you could animate them through keyframes and then put together your video and then share it. And this is even pre-YouTube, of course. So sharing them was, you know, you share them any way that you could get the files around. But what's so interesting about this now 27-year-old product is people still love it, and people still make crazy stuff with it. And if you go up on YouTube, you're going to find all kinds of fan videos about 3D Movie Maker. And you needed, like, you know, Windows 95, Windows 98. And as with all products, these things start to age and start to rot, and then things go away. But the fandom lives on. And I think people were really asking for a modern version of that. And Foon, as a self-proclaimed software necromancer bringing dead things back to life, decided that it was their mission in life to make this happen.
I think that's fantastic. So I have to say, I have some fondness of applications that looked similar to this. I can remember installing them on the computer, and there was Crayola Rock, I think it was called, or Crayola Art, but it had all of these floppy disks you had to pop in to get it loaded up. And it looked so much like this that's also what kind of made me immediately draw in to pay attention to this and trying to create those videos using this software. So I'm curious if you yourself have any fond memories of 3D Movie Maker, if you created any videos at the time or you know, played with it after it had come out, or if you know anyone that did or does.
Yeah. So I was already, I think, in my 20s when this came out. So it depends on the age that you were when you were experiencing 3D Movie Maker. For a lot of folks, millennials and folks maybe just a smidge older, there was an opportunity when you're about 12 and it's like, I can make stuff, and this game is unapologetically creative. So they would create videos of a certain kind. I think my videos were a little bit more dramatic. I think some of the fun videos that the younger people made were always rat themed. There's a lot of great rat videos. If you search YouTube for things like the huge rat, and it's like, you know, a 2-minute long tour de force about a rat that terrorizes, you know, so there's just tons of rat videos because the rat model was really cool that came with 3D Movie Maker. And some of them are very Vine-like, where it's like, here's the story of a rat in 20 seconds. And, you know, and people in the comments on YouTube will say, it's high drama, and this was a tour de force. We need a 4K re-rendered version of this. Mine were mostly just driving around, kind of like Grand Theft Auto style.
Oh, man, I've got a lot of YouTube videos to watch after this, because there are quite a few that have gotten so many views. I mean, this thing is clearly very popular, even to this day. So this is kind of where I would love if you could share the story of what led you down the route of wanting or of working to open source this. We talked a little bit about Foon, but I'm just curious, you know, where were you when the tweet came through, or when did you come across this and thought, you know what, actually, I think I can do something about this? Because you also talked about that recently, about telling a developer that they can't do something and what that does. So tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so as you've mentioned before, we and the community want to give full credit to Foon Touring for their quixotic quest to make this happen. This has been something that Foon has been very vocal about over the years, saying that this is something that should happen. And I've made a couple of runs at it. But on April 6th, as you can see here, Foon said, hey, Microsoft, give me the source code. And once it hit somewhere around 5,000 likes, I started feeling nerd sniped. And nerd sniping is when you tell a programmer or a nerd that something can't be done. And I felt that this was a really great use of social media by Foon to say that, you know, I bet you can't do that, Microsoft. Just give it to me. Like, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, why can't we? So I started making inquiries, and I feel that my role as an old person on the internet, as well as a somewhat visible representative of Microsoft, is to lend my privilege And in this context, my privilege is access. So I started emailing people. I emailed the Microsoft Open Source Office. I tried to find some of the programmers at the company that are still here now, even years later, who worked on the original thing. Hey, do you know who owns this? And where can we find that? And where is the source code anyway? Like, where do you put source from 1995? And how would we license this? And what would that look like? And what does open source mean in the context of something that's 27 years old? And it was Foon's encouragement and guidance that allowed me to feel emboldened to ask that question. And then I found some supportive vice presidents and people at Microsoft who were like, yeah, you know, that would actually be kind of cool. Let's do that. So then we dug into the archives. We actually have a formal archivist and an archive system at Microsoft for products that are this old. And we dug them off of tapes or wherever that that dusty source code came from.
Wow. So was this in person, the part where you actually were talking to the archivist, or was all of this able to happen kind of in online exchanges as you were trying to figure that out?
That's a good question. I did not actually enter the end of Indiana Jones when they go into the giant Costco with all of the dusty stuff. I'm sure someone did that at some point, but I was able to do all of this remotely from my home in Portland. Everyone was very supportive and was very like curious, because everyone likes getting nerd sniped and going, you know, I don't know if I could find that. Let me go and look for that. So what they did is they found the original stuff, and it came on like 21 CDs. And then they gave me a dump, and they said, here's the dump, the unfiltered dump of it. And then I work with Jeff Wilcox and our friends at the Open Source Office, and then we have to prepare source for release. So that means looking for swear words, looking for, you know, references to countries that don't exist geopolitically anymore. We need to remove PII, right? You don't want to have an intern's name or email address in the source code unless they ask. So we had to talk to each of the developers who worked on it, see if they wanted their name in the comments or not. Some of them kept their names in. And you'll see that in other places. You'll just see I used a regular expression and I replaced it with asterisks. All of those considerations we run through any software when we release it. And it's also worth pointing out that there is open source and then there is source opened. And I think it's fair to say that, as we pointed out, this is an archived, read-only, historical, release of some open source with no warranty expressed or implied, with the intent that the community and Foon and friends would pick this up and run with it. So what we did is we released it after it had been scrubbed. Parts of it built, parts of it didn't. There was no intent to get it to build perfectly. You can't just take the stuff that Microsoft releases and build it because it's 27 years old and it needs old compilers. But then we immediately marked it as archived and read-only with the intent that Microsoft's not going to take pull requests. We're not going to maintain this, because we knew, and this is important and why Foon and their community is so important, is that there was a welcoming, ready community there. And if you go to places like 3dmm.com, there's an active forum of excited people. And the top thread is the Movie Maker source code is here. And they're like, let's go. You know? So people were ready for it. It was not just released for reference. You know, it was released to have someone go and take it to the future. So if you click on 3DMM chat there, and then look at the top list, look at the, you know, people are like, look, 3D Movie Maker source code. They're at the top pinned one there. And you grab that one and people are like, this is awesome. And then here's another interesting point. I could scroll up just a smidge there. Someone said, this is amazing. I have no idea how to use any of these files.
Yes.
Right. Because there's two different kinds of people that care about this. There are our archivists and our software necromancers like Foon who are like, this is interesting source. This is a piece of history. This is something I can build into the future and make new software with. I could maybe make a 4K version, make a modern version. I could get it to run on Linux. Who knows what our tech friends are going to do with this code. It's MIT released, so we encourage them to enjoy it. But for those that just want to make movies, they can go and check out Foon's release up on github.com/Foon. And they made a thing called 3D Movie Maker Forever at github.com/Foon. And they're working with the community to go and make a forked version of this that'll be able to build. And they've had some success. I think they're having some challenges with sound right now, but I'm excited to see what they come up with in the future.
That's incredible. That I was curious because you did mention using some regular expressions. How much of the process of sort of getting the code ready for release in this way was automated, and how much of it was you and whoever else was helping you having to go in and check things? Because that's I think what's cool about this is if it was just sort of a little, I'm going to try this and see if it can happen, then I think that any bit of friction would have stopped some people up, but you kept going until it actually got out there. And so, I'm curious about the process of actually going in and removing comments or adjusting things. Was it a lot of work?
Mm-hmm. That is a great question. It was a lot of work, and I appreciate, and we have processes for that, and the open source office was super helpful in helping me understand those things. I've open sourced things before, but not things this old. So things that I was surprised about are mentions of countries that no longer exist, like on the world stage, and the mention of the existence of that country might offend someone, so we have to think about those things. We noticed there were possible references to somewhat problematic terms because this was the 90s. Sometimes you'll get false positives where a variable name might seem offensive, but it's actually just a pointer to a file. And it's like, oh, that's not this word, that's this acronym. Right. And then you have to explain that to the lawyer who is saying, you need to change that variable name. And it's like, that's not a bad word, that's a whatever. That right. is just manual grind, long email threads about stuff. And then the other issue that people don't realize and why I'm getting requests for other products to be open sourced and like, why can't you just do that? And I want this open source product is that they have third-party dependencies. And one of the things that I want to give Foon another shout out for was brokering a deal with a gentleman named Jez San from Argonautics, who wrote a thing called B-Render, which is a legendary 3D engine. And that is a fundamental core part of the 3D Movie Maker. And along with Foon's help, we found Jez, who is now, I believe, kind of retired and chilling, and said, hey, we'd love to open source, you know, Movie Maker, but the heart of it is this 3D engine. Can we open source that too? Getting that third-party buy-off was super important. And, and Foon facilitated a lot of that as well. So credit to them as well.
Awesome. Well, I think that this is a very interesting story, and I appreciate you taking the time to kind of walk us through it. And certainly, we'll be keeping an eye on the GitHub there and paying attention there. I have to ask, because if I don't, then they'll be mad at me. Mary Jo Foley and Paul Thurrott of Windows Weekly here on Twit. They said, "Oh, Scott's going to be on tomorrow. Oh, can you ask him anything you'd like to tell us about Build, which is coming up very soon?"
I would encourage folks who are listening and our friends on the internet to register for Build. It's coming up the 24th and 25th in 2 weeks. It's going to be virtual. I live here in Portland, Oregon, but I will say that I just got back from Seattle last night, and I got them to give me a camera crew, and I was wandering around anywhere that I could get badge access to and seeing if I could get some behind the scenes footage. You know, I think that Builds and Google IOs are very formal and they're very much like, here's a vice president talking to some people. I was running around behind the scenes, like catching people when they step off stage. Hey, can I talk to you about something? I got some footage, my friends. I'm really excited. I've done a thing called Build After Hours. So you're going to be able to watch Build. And then as it winds down, we're going to wander around backstage and we're going to talk to not just vice presidents, but the people who build the stuff. And it's some of the work that I'm the most proud of. And it's going to give people a level of access and, you know, gonzo footage of just, I'm on my iPhone talking to somebody that you wouldn't ordinarily see at a tech conference. And I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I'm looking forward to that. All right. So, of course, folks know that you do great work for Microsoft. If they want to follow you online and check out that great work and also listen to your podcast, where should they go to look for all of that?
I appreciate that. You can check me out at Hanselman.com and from there jump off to my YouTube and my podcast called Hansel Minutes. And then I would also encourage you to follow Foon at Foone and check out Foon.org for their great work in the software archivist kind of genre.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Scott. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Alrighty, folks. Up next, the Mozilla Foundation takes a look at the privacy, or I guess lack thereof, of mental health apps and services. Before we get there, though, I do want to tell you about Nareva, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. Complicated and costly. That has been the state of audio conferencing for larger spaces for a long time. Choosing a traditional system might entail difficult design software and selecting from a dizzying array of separate mics, speakers, DSPs, and more. An installation usually requires outside technicians and is often highly invasive and expensive. It could take your room offline for days. The industry was definitely primed for the same type of leap in technology that had transformed and simplified other sectors. Nareva made that leap when they created revolutionary microphone mist technology. With this patented technology, one or two integrated microphone and speaker bars fill a room with thousands of small virtual microphones. There are no dead zones and everyone can be heard everywhere in the room. Meeting and class participants can simply talk and move naturally in the space and still be heard by remote participants. Thanks to continuous auto calibration, your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. No outside technician required. Nareva also simplified installation. It's a 30-minute DIY job. That means big savings on time and cost compared to traditional systems. They simplified management as well. Nareva Console gives IT the power to monitor, to manage, and adjust their systems from anywhere. No need for IT to go from room to room. So ask yourself if you want to go with the costly and complicated traditional system or make the leap to simple and economical Nareva. Learn more at Nareva.com. That's Nareva.com. Thank you so much to Nareva for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right. You have probably seen a whole host of advertisements or Instagram posts or Twitter tweets flying by that talk about different mental health apps and services. There are a lot out there that you can check out, that you can download, that you can use. But what about the privacy considerations of these applications? Have you thought about how these services may or may not be sharing your data online? Joining us today is someone who is considering the privacy implications of these apps and services from the Mozilla Foundation. It's Misha Rykov. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you. So I would hope that you can kind of kick things off by telling us, because maybe folks who are tuning in, they hear about your focus here on mental health apps, but this is part of a larger guide called the Privacy Not Included Guide. And this is a wonderful source for anyone to go and check out if they want to. Could you tell us about the Privacy Not Included Guide, please?
Sure. So this guide started in 2017 by our lead, Jen Kaltrider. She looked at mainly at consumer guides, and she found out that there are of like connected devices, microphones and smart home devices, smart doorbells and these things. She found out that there are a lot of data points about their size and about their volume, but there is almost no information about how they treat and data and if they're secure at all. So she came up with this idea to do a shopping guide to help users choose devices based on the privacy and security of such. And I joined 1 year ago, and with me we look now not only at the actual physical devices, but also at the apps. So mental health apps and prayer apps is our recent addition. But in the past, we also looked at dating apps and the video call apps and such.
Understood. So, okay, this is interesting because I think that the smart home is one of those places where folks maybe are a little bit more front of mind, especially if you put a camera in your home. I know lots of folks who are sort of suspicious of Amazon Echoes in people's houses. And so it's no surprise that that kind of was the kickoff for this guide, that we can look at those and say, hey, here are how these apps are collecting or not collecting your information. Here's where it's being stored. But then you had to kind of step further into things and look at how apps are doing that as well, because I think a lot of us tap the little allow. Okay. Let's move past this. I've definitely read the terms and conditions and the privacy policy except. Could you tell us about when did you end up adding mental health apps to the list, and what made you folks want to add mental health apps to the list? What made you want to study these mental health apps?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, when you look at privacy and security, it is easy to get this professional defamation, get a bit more paranoid about stuff. For example, just before I was talking, you did some introduction of some sound system, and you said that everyone can hear everything everywhere there with this system. And I guess you meant this as a cool thing, but when I look from privacy perspective, I'm like, okay, but do they ask for consent of people? Yeah. How do they store this data, for how long? And then have a lot of questions in your mind every time you work with such things. And with application, indeed, it's even harder because with apps, the developers are often not that transparent. And then the device itself does not tell you that much. Like Android can tell you a bit less than iPhone, but even they cannot force developers to really provide all of this data. So when we saw all the news about mental health apps being like really a hype since a few years, really like the next big business model for the startups, when we saw the huge investors from Silicon Valley invest into such and also invest into the prayer apps, we had a big question, okay, but is it just about business, or is it also about privacy and security and safety and not even talking about actually doing the mission and helping people with their mental health? And then we thought, okay, soon is May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Why don't we do this research? And we interviewed 32 apps. 27 of them are mental health apps and 5 are prayer apps, the apps for praying to God.
Oh, okay. And how, I think folks would want to know kind of what is involved in the process of doing the research for these apps, because this is one of those things where, an average user might not have the time to go through and do this. And now that this guide is available, they can make use of it. But what steps do you folks take in adding these different apps to the Privacy Not Included guide?
Yeah, so we have like different layers approach to it. First, we start with just minimum security standards. We look at 5 things. We check if apps have encryption, if they require strong password, if they push security updates, if they manage vulnerabilities. And here, ideally, we expect the developer to have bug bounty program to invite security researchers to write to them. And then we check if the app has privacy policy. That's These are like simplest things. And since a few years, we saw that most of the apps, most of the devices, they meet these 5. So then we look beyond that. We look into the actual privacy policy. And then we check what data is collected and why, what rights people have. Like, can people delete this data? For how long is it stored? And how do apps use this data? Like, we would love to see that they do not sell it and do not share it for advertisement without our consent. That's just one of the examples. Mm-hmm. And lastly, we have what we call like a Facebook check. Like, even if the app does all of that, then we just look into the news. What's the history of how they treat data? For example, a giant like Facebook has decent security and privacy division, but they also have a huge, like, just track record of data leaks. And mm-hmm. then we put it as well into the guide. And then based on these three things, we can put dinks, and then we can put an overall dink on the app, saying that we think that with this app, privacy is not included.
Yeah. And in fact, going through and clicking on some of these, you can see the thumbs ups or thumbs downs, how people feel about it is a really interesting thing. I like that you've included this voting mechanism to determine how someone feels about it. And then, as you noted, actually going and finding these news pieces gives people so much information that they can use to really kind of take steps to better understand it. And I like, props to you and the team for working on this, because this is, I can't even fathom the amount of work that this takes, but it's such an incredible guide. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to have you on, so that more people could know about this. I want to shout this guide to the rooftops and say, hey, you've got to check this out. You've got to see what's there, because I think that that advocacy that we do as, you know, working in this space, but then the ability for people to take it within their own hands and make this happen. I'm curious if any particular mental health apps stuck out for you as having glaring violations of user privacy, if there were any that you thought, why does this app even exist, or why does this service even exist? Did any kind of stick out, or were they all kind of not doing what needed to be done? Or maybe you were pleasantly surprised that a lot of them did protect user privacy?
Well, mental health apps are like, in general, like, the worst privacy-wise type of product that we looked at, and privacy not included exists since 5 years. So that's quite bad. Wow. Out of these 32 apps that we looked at, we can recommend only two. And we say that only four are kind of okay. So most of the apps are bad, and that's like, now you're trolling it and everywhere you see the exclamation mark in a triangle. That's mm-hmm. the app that we don't recommend at all.
Wow.
A lot of apps allowed just password of 111. One app just allowed 11. And there was also one app that where I could just sign up my partner without like telling her. And she was like, thank you for signing me up, but I didn't know, because the app didn't require email authorization or any kind of password. I could just type in her email and then look and then use this app as her app. And disclaimer, wow, that was a prayer app. So most of the big apps didn't meet our expectations with basic privacy. They share data to advertisers. It's unclear how to delete data from there. They collect more data than they kind of need. Their privacy policies are very complicated and complex, and we really had a huge amount of time speaking with lawyers and encrypting what they mean there. And the lawyers are also confused, yeah? So to call out particular ones, again, like, all the biggest ones, we have problems with them. So if you look at Talkspace, BetterHelp, 7Cups, Modern Health, they did earn a ding. And the particular app to highlight was pray.com, which is there for people to pray, but it earned all the dings that we have. So they had a huge data leak. They share data with advertisers for commercial purposes. They didn't answer us, so we don't even know if they manage security vulnerabilities. We didn't find any leak, any link to send them, hello, you have this and that bug. So yeah, maybe Prey.com is the one to highlight as, unfortunately, the one that just checked all of our boxes for being not that careful about privacy of data.
Understood. And I think to round out our conversation, I was wondering if you could provide folks with, now that you've done this research and continue to do this research, someone watching this who says, oh my, you know, I was using one of these apps and I am concerned about my privacy, I'm concerned about protections. What are some tips on how users can protect their privacy while they're using these apps? And is there any advice you would give on understanding a privacy policy or terms and conditions?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's really hard to give tips on understanding privacy policies because we do not understand them ourselves much. We just call out, this clause is impossible to understand, and that's the issue by itself. Like they say, we will not sell you data unless... And then they write something that doesn't make like logical sense, at least to me. And I started mathematics, so I had some classes in logic. Yeah, so it's really hard to give people advice on that. But I would recommend to really just when you open privacy policies, try how quickly it takes you behind all of this legalese language to find answer to simple questions. And the simple questions is, do they sell data? What a consent is and how they ask for it? Can you delete data and how do they provide you an email to just write, hello, I want all of my data erased? Do they collect and they combine data with third party sources? And if they write for which purpose, what kind of data they collect from you. If you can find answers to such simple questions quickly, then it's a nice app. Yeah. If you open the policy and you don't understand a word and then you say that they say we may share your data for such reasons, and then you see 1,000 words. Then probably they can. What they mean is, we can do whatever we want with your data, and we just write it in such a way so that no one can sue us.
That's really good advice.
That's the truth, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Yeah. I think that's really good advice. Again, everyone needs to head to the, we'll include a link in the show notes so that everyone can check out the Privacy Not Included guide. Do you have any links or social media that you want to share with our listeners where they can keep up with the work that you're doing?
I really just go to privacynotincluded.com. All right. And that's where we have everything.
Excellent. Misha, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day today to talk to me. And hopefully we'll be able to have you back on in the future as you continue to build out the guide.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Up next is my first story of the week. Before we get there, though, I do want to tell you about NetFoundry, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. Networking has traditionally been handled by dedicated teams and personnel. You could say network security has been deemed too important to leave in the hands of developers. One of our sponsors, NetFoundry, they believe differently. Secure connectivity is too important to be taken away from developers and has forced dependency and stifled innovation and business velocity, or unnecessarily trades off security for those benefits. Therefore, NetFoundry created and maintains OpenZeedee, providing an open source, we were just talking about open source software earlier today, free and easy way for the world to embed zero trust networking into anything. It provides everything you need to spin up a truly private zero trust overlay network in minutes across anything directly in your app on any device or in any cloud. I can't say enough anys here. It works so many places. It's built on principles of extensibility, flexibility, and scalability. Attacks from insecure networks can become a thing of the past. External network attacks, including DDoS attacks, brute force, credential stuffing, CVE or zero-day exploits, BGP hijacks, phishing, and more can be stopped. This is truly zero trust of all networks. There's no need for expensive and risky reactive patching. Agnostic design patterns ensure you only need commodity internet with outbound ports without needing networking engineering skills to implement it. Say goodbye to complex firewall rules, inbound ports, public DNS, static network access controls, and VPNs. Yes, you could even say goodbye to VPNs. Spring for Shell and Windows RPC RCE are recent exploits or CVEs. The recommendation is to cloud inbound ports, but OpenZD allows you to have no inbound ports at all. OpenZD was mentioned in Java Magazine about how they ZDified the Spring Boot for any Java app. What's the moral of the story? Those who make themselves dark cannot be exploited by Spring for Shell or other network attacks. Eliminate the tug of war between developers and security. The former can work programmatically with software, while the latter have isolated apps driven by policy, visibility, and logs they require. Zero trust is a journey, so start wherever you need based on your priorities. OpenZD offers numerous SDKs, tunneling apps for popular OSs, and edge routers in cloud marketplaces. If you don't want to host OpenZD, use the NetFoundry SaaS, including free forever tiers for up to 10 endpoints. My goodness, that is a lot of free. Head to netfoundry.io/twit to grab some free swag like stickers, including the ZD itself. Look at it. Look at it. It's so cute. And check this out. Got my OpenZD shirt. This is Ziggy, the mascot. So cute with the waving the wand. It says, get an invisibility cloak for your apps, zd.dev. So grab some free swag, learn more, and get started. That's netfoundry.io/twit. That's the URL you want to use because you'll be letting them know that you came from this and get your free swag shirt, some stickers. Who knows what'll come your way? I also got a NetFoundry mug as well. So join there, netfoundry.io/twit. Get your free swag and the free tier now. Thank you so much to NetFoundry for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, folks, you may have heard, you may have even watched as we had some coverage here on the network of Google's I.O. keynote kicking off Google I.O. this week. This is Google's developer conference that they hold every year, similar to how Apple has a developer conference where developers come and learn about what's coming to Google and the platform in general. But it's also, it tends to be a time when Google announces some new hardware as well. And that is the case yet again this year for Google I/O 2022, where the company announced quite a few bits of software or hardware, excuse me. The first one is the Google Pixel 6a. This is Google's latest Pixel 6. They have the Pixel 6, the Pixel 6 Pro, and the Pixel 6a The Verge calls it, its mid-tier phone. This is a $449 phone. It comes in sage, chalk, and what's the third color? Let's see there. Charcoal. Sage, chalk, and charcoal. So it's not like, because I've got a Pixel 6 here, and this one's called Sorta Seafoam. And you can see there are two different colors involved in this. It's a glass back, and I believe aluminum sides on the Google Pixel 6. So this one is is available for $449. It is a little bit more price conscious than the phones that Google offered early on. And with this, it tended to be in the past that these Pixel 6a phones had cameras that were a lot like the Pixel 6 and 6 Pro, but they just didn't have as good of a processor. But this time, Google flipped the script, as The Verge notes, where you don't get as good of cameras. You get a 12 megapixel camera versus 50 megapixels. And you get instead the same processor, which I'm not surprised because Google has been working on its own Tensor chip and of course included that in the Pixel 6 and 6 Pro and continues to iterate on this technology, bringing it in line with Apple's own silicon that it offers. And so I'm not surprised to see that included in this phone as well. And when the company's looking for cost-cutting options, if they want to make sure that every phone features the Tensor chip to kind of focus on their own technology, then I'm not surprised that they kind of looked for other ways to be able to remove cost. Interestingly, there's no headphone jack in this phone. Meanwhile, just last year, they were very happy to talk about how their Pixel, what was it, the 5A or the Pixel of the year past did include a headphone jack. You do not get it this time around. So everybody's all locked in on the no headphone jacks kind of phone. And yes, as Chickenhead is pointing out in the chat, it's very courageous. It will be available, let's see, July 21st, available to pre-order. So if you are looking to pre-order the Pixel 6a, the more cost-friendly phone, you'll be able to do that in July, late July. Then, folks, I think were kind of curious if Google was going to announce it because it was taking a while to get around to it. But they did announce the Google Pixel Watch. The Google Pixel Watch won't be coming until the fall when the Pixel 7 and 7 Pro are announced. But they gave us a go-ahead. They went ahead and gave us a look at it, given the fact that this watch had kind of already leaked due to a I left it in a bar situation. I do love that it's the circular design. I've rocked an Apple Watch since Series Zero, and they've never done the circular style. And I do like the circular style with this really pretty domed glass on top. It also features your standard crown on the side, which I do believe is also twistable. They call it the tactile crown instead of the digital crown, as Apple calls it. And it is an extension of your Pixel devices. That's definitely how they see it, as kind of an addition to the experience, and gives you the ability to do a lot of what you can do on your Pixel device right there on your wrist. This is going to be Google's first built from the inside out watch, because of course there's Android Wear that provides the software for different third-party Android watches to use. And some of them, of course, didn't even use that software. But here, you get to have the Google Pixel Watch. As Scooter X points out in the chat, there's no word yet if the Pixel Watch will connect to an iPhone. That is an interesting question, because, of course, Apple provides the Apple Watch to, and it works, you know, perfectly with the iPhone, but it actually requires an iPhone to get it set up. And it is a device that only works if you're in that, if you're in Apple's kind of walled garden. So if people would be able to buy a Pixel Watch and download an app to their iPhone that would then interface with the Pixel Watch, that would be interesting. That could, man, now I'm kind of curious when this comes out, if they're going to end up doing that, because that's sort of one more look at how Apple kind of keeps its own little thing over in its corner and does not have any interest in sort of playing ball with the other places. On top of those, I thought this was kind of funny. Google's hardware seems to leak no matter what, all the time. And other Android devices end up leaking all the time. And so I think Google was like, you know what? We might as well just be preemptive about this. We might as well just go ahead and show you. It's not coming out until the fall, but they went ahead and showed the Pixel 7 and Pixel 7 Pro, which they look very pretty. They've got this really nice aluminum back. Of course, upgrades to the cameras, as you would expect. And they also seem to feature the glass back that you would be used to with the more premium devices. But yeah, you got a first look on stage and they showed those off. They'll have the next generation of the Google Tensor chip in it, which I'm not surprised about as well. That makes perfect sense. So we'll see that very soon as well. And then after the Google Pixel 7 and Pixel 7 Pro were shown, they also revealed a new pair of Google Pixel Buds. These are called the Google Pixel Buds Pro, and they provide the Pro features that one would expect from some in-ear true wireless headphones. I have some Google Pixel Buds, and they are fantastic headphones already, in-earphones, I guess. They sound fine. The connection has never been an issue for me, and they're very comfortable, and the battery lasts a long time. These new ones, which will be available for $199, a reminder that Apple's own AirPods Pro are $249. So you're paying less for these ones. They have active noise cancellation. And because of the chip that's built in, it's got an audio processing chip built into the actual earbud that will listen to the environment and do the necessary noise cancellation that takes place. And they're not doing... One of the things that Apple does with the AirPods Pro is there's a microphone that faces the inside of the ear canal and then microphones that face out. And the built-in chips in those listen to the noise inside of your ear and outside of your ear to be able to keep the noise down. Google did not mention any microphone inside of the ear listening in the ear canal, but they did mention a technology that is supposed to block outside sound from coming into your ear if you don't have a good seal on your on the buds themselves. It's unclear what that meant. It was all very hand-wavy and sort of vague. But I'm curious to hear people's review of these as they come out. They are also going to be available for pre-order on July 21st. And I'm sincerely thinking about getting them, given that they have this active noise cancellation. I've had such a good experience with the Pixel Buds non-pro. Then there's also the new Pixel tablet. This got a very, very brief mention. And in fact, it hasn't been approved by the FCC yet. So it's, you know, kind of in not early stages, but early enough stages. And what I found fascinating about this device is that it looks like someone took a Nest Hub Max and just ripped the screen off of it and then handed it over and said, here you go, because it's shaped very similarly to a Nest Hub Max. And it also has the camera built on the landscape side of the tablet instead of the portrait side of the tablet. So that's unlike the iPad of any size or variety. And it'll be interesting to see how the Pixel tablet ends up coming out and looking, given that the company has, in the latest versions of Android, really focused on that tablet experience. Or in some cases, you've got an unfoldable or a foldable device that also plays a role. And then we got as if that wasn't enough, one more thing. At the very end, they showed, Anthony, what's that company that makes the glasses?
The Focals by North?
Yeah. At the very end, they showed what seems to be the next generation of the Focals by North. So, of course, Google purchased this company. And, you know, we kind of wondered, hey, what was going to be happening next? And they showed off a pair of AR glasses that were used for translation during a conversation. So they're wearing the glasses, they're talking to someone in front of them, and on the glasses, they are able to see the text of the translation appear in front of them so that they can say, oh, I understand, you know, what the person's saying and be able to talk back to them. It's unclear what other features there might be in the future, how these would work. But I think that what Google was really showing off here was this was an opportunity to say, here is one very clear and realistic implementation of these glasses in the real world, why someone would want to put these on their face and wear them around. This was able to show that that functionality and say, oh, okay, this is one real world use for AR. And now, if you're watching, you can see this person gets very excited as they see the text showing up on the lenses inside of their vision. So I'm obviously looking forward to seeing as companies this year and I think next year start to reveal their AR, their take on AR and their AR technology. Lastly, Google announced a whole heck of a lot about Android 13. They talked about Google Wallet returning and also providing a feature where you can use virtual cards on different sites. So they'll automatically generate, you have your one actual card and then the system can generate a card that is specific to a different site, depending on what you're visiting. So that can help keep you from having your credentials taken. And then a lot of focus, as is usual, on AI. Google's search features, including multi-search, its photo search, and everything in between got mentioned on stage as they continue to improve upon those technologies. So there was a lot that was there at Google I.O. that was announced this year. And a lot worth checking out. In fact, yes, there's a site, a page you can go to, 100 things we announced at I.O. So check that out to see what I may have missed. I just wanted to cover the highlights there. And that's that. All right, folks, we're going to take another quick break before we come back with the rest of the show, my story of the week, as we round things out. I want to tell you about New Relic, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. If you're a software engineer, you've been there. It's 9 p.m. or maybe it's later. Maybe it's midnight. Maybe it's 2 a.m. You're finally unwinding from work. Your phone buzzes with an alert and something's broken. Your mind's already racing at what could be wrong. Is it the back end or the front end? Is it global? Is it the server? Is it the network? Is it the cloud provider? We're asking so many questions that we don't know the answer to. Do we have slow running queries? Did I introduce a bug in my last deploy? Now the whole team all over the place scrambling from tool to tool and messaging person after person to find and fix the issue. Get this. According to New Relic, they did a study and the report says only half all organizations are implementing observability for their networks and systems. The report showed how maintaining network observability continues to be an issue for companies around the world. That's not going to happen. That won't happen if you get New Relic. New Relic combines 16 different monitoring products that you'd normally buy separately, so engineering teams can see across their entire software stack in one place. You'll get application monitoring, APM, so unified monitoring for your apps and microservices. You'll get Kubernetes and Pixie, instant Kubernetes observability with Pixie. Distributed tracing, see all your traces without management headaches so you can find and fix issues fast. Network performance monitoring, stop guessing where performance issues start and ditch data silos for a system-wide correlated view and so much more. More importantly, you can pinpoint issues down to the line of code so you know exactly why the problem happened and can resolve it quickly. That's why the dev and ops teams at DoorDash, at GitHub, at Epic Games, and more than 14,000 other companies use New Relic to debug and improve their software. Whether you run a cloud-native startup or a Fortune 500 company, it takes just 5 minutes to set up New Relic in your environment. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does, and you can get access to the whole New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free per month forever. No credit card required. Sign up at newrelic.com/TNW. That's newrelic.com/TNW. In case you forgot, newrelic.com/TNW. And of course, my thanks to New Relic for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Appreciate you. All right. The last thing I want to talk about, I was just mentioning VR, AR. Mark Zuckerberg decided to show off some new technology from Meta called the Meta Cambria or Project Cambria. And this is an interesting take on something that Meta has been working on with the current Oculus Quest 2. It's this mixed reality headset where it is, it's kind of fascinating because, so AR, the idea with AR is that you have something that augments your vision. It's called augmented reality, meaning it lays something over your vision, but it doesn't completely take over your vision. So a pair of glasses that have the time and the date and a contact detail that pops up when you are walking into a meeting that is with the different people on your calendar. VR, virtual reality, is something that completely replaces your vision with something else. So like an Oculus Quest 2, you strap that thing on your head and you can't see anything that's around you in the real world, but instead see what's in this virtual environment that's placed in front of you. What Facebook is working on, and again, what they already have started to do with the Quest 2, is providing this technology that is a mixture of both, because you put the headset on and you can be in virtual reality, but then you can also be in an augmented version of virtual reality. It has these high quality cameras built into the headset that shows you what's around you physically. But then because it is a digital view of what's around you instead of the actual view that's around you, then they are able to easily overlay images in an augmented way. So it's like VR asterisk, and then underneath where the asterisk is in tiny text, it says, or maybe it's AR asterisk with a tiny text below it that says, actually VR. Because technically you are looking at a virtual reality in front of you, not the real thing. Now, this true feature set is going to be on the Cambria, whether that's what they end up calling it or not, it would be the Meta Cambria. But you can use some of these features already on the Oculus Quest 2. And as Mark Zuckerberg's post says, there will be some software that will be available for folks to use on the Quest 2. So right now, if I put on the Oculus Quest 2 headset, I can double tap on the side of the display and it shows me a black and white view of the space around me, not full color, but it shows me a black and white view of the space around me. And that is primarily used to make sure that I'm not running into something or I know where I'm standing and what I'm trying to see. But what they have added over time is the ability to have different things in the real world appear inside of your vision in that virtual space. So my dogs, for example, if I am wearing the headset and I'm in one of my marked out spaces in, say, my living room, and a dog walks in, then that dog can be overlaid into that virtual space so that I can see, oh, I don't want to step forward and accidentally step on Mizzy's paw. And that technology is going to be implemented further They've already also offered the ability to, you can sit at a desk and you can put your desk in virtual space. That remains still virtual, but then you can have a keyboard and mouse in virtual space as well. And those will appear there for you to be able to type on and to see what you're doing. That's very handy if you want to work at your desk and be able to use the Oculus's virtual desktop features where you are computing in virtual space. So all of those are some really cool features that already exist that are in this sort of mixed reality zone that you wouldn't get otherwise. And Cambria is seemingly going to take that to the next level because, again, the way that it works now is it's a black and white view. It is not this full color view. But when the Cambria comes out, it's supposed to offer this in full color, that you would get these actual visual experiences of what's around you. So they originally announced this headset or gave like a brief glimpse of the outline of this headset at the last Oculus event. And I know, Anthony, you and I were kind of talking about how it was, you know, something that we're keeping in the back of our minds, because I've thought a few times about getting another Oculus Quest 2 so that my partner and I could both have one. Yeah. But I've held off because I want this Cambria.
I've been waiting. I'm ready.
Yeah, exactly. I'm ready. Because I have to say, I have enjoyed the Oculus, I can't think of what it's called now, the Meta Horizons, Meta World. I can't think of what it is, but basically it's this virtual world that Meta created that is supposed to be, you know, part of the metaverse. And it has all these tools for building up your own world, your own environment, your own stages with games and all this stuff that you can play. But I always get, after a while, kind of claustrophobic in that. And I'm curious if something that provides an AR view will make a difference for me.
Yeah, I think so. You know, even when, like, we've tried the more ARs, what was the...
HoloLens?
Not HoloLens, the other one that, like, was
Magic
really
Leap.
Hyped. Magic Leap, yeah, we got to try that out. And, you know, like, you know, definitely interacting, like, more... Being less isolated and interacting in your mm-hmm. environment definitely, you know, makes it different and interesting in its own ways.
That's what I'm hopeful for. I know that one did get kind of overhyped and that the HoloLens has gone completely corporate. But it seems like these companies, Google, Microsoft, perhaps, and Apple and Meta are all focusing on either doing both or they're focusing on AR, because I think that value proposition is much more reasonable than saying, hey, put this thing on your head and disappear. You know, you're not part of your world anymore. We want you to go away. That can kind of, I think, cut some people off. And so I'm not surprised to see this headset, which can serve as both. I like that idea that I can go completely VR if I want to, but I can almost like flip up a shade and I'm suddenly in a mixed reality space.
And the other challenge with the actual AR headsets is like they can only get it framed in like a tiny window in your view. But with the VR aspect, like you get the whole like camera view and you can put all the AR stuff in.
That's a really good point.
Areas, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then it's got that sort of object tracking too, where if I put something behind me and I turn, it's not still in the corner of my vision. It's stuck behind me where it's supposed to be. So I can turn around and go back to the whiteboard or whatever it is that I have up in virtual space. Yeah, that's a really good point. So that is what we know now about Meta's mixed reality headset that should be coming or should be announced at some point, I think this year. We'll, of course, be keeping an eye on that as well as that comes around. Tech News Weekly, that is now coming to an end. It publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. So you can head there to subscribe to the show in audio and video formats. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. We're in all the places that you want to get your podcasts. And we try to be, at least. I should mention too that if you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, there is a way to do that. All you have to do is check out Club Twit, twit.tv/clubtwit. For $7 a month, you get every single Twitch show with no ads, completely ad-free content. You get that warm, fuzzy feeling knowing that you're supporting us. That's why you don't get ads, because instead you are paying for the show. And you also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. That includes AMAs. That includes fireside chats. That includes everything in between. Lots of great stuff there worth checking out. And last but not least, you get access to the Discord server. That is a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members, but also those of us here at Twit. My co-host on iOS Today, Rosemary Orchard, is incredibly active in the Club Twit Discord. And I am supposed to be getting something this Sunday that is a popular but hard to find item that has to do with gaming. And if it does come on Sunday, I'm planning on kicking up a little live thing in the Discord to do an unboxing of it before we do a full review with everybody else who wants to be involved with it at Twit. So there's a little hint, or not even a hint, just a little reason for you to go and check out Club Twit. Again, twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month to check it out. And if you would like, you can subscribe to individual shows on Apple Podcasts. If you use Apple Podcasts, just type in Tech News Weekly in Apple Podcasts, find the audio version of the feed. You'll see a button you can tap to subscribe for $2.99 a month, and that gets you an ad-free version of the audio feed right there. If you'd like to tweet at me or follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, that's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Of course, you can check out on Tuesdays, iOS Today, which I record with Rosemary Orchard. And I should be back in studio this Saturday for The Tech Guy, the radio show that I co-host with the one and only Leo Laporte, where we take questions, tech questions from around the United States and elsewhere. So that should be fun. And Jason Howell will be back next week, fingers crossed. Now's the time to thank our TD today, which is Anthony Nielsen. Are you also editing the show today?
I am.
All right. Well, thank you for that as well.
You're welcome.
And of course, always a huge thanks to Burke, who is one of the studio engineers and who typically does the setup calls with our guests to make sure that they sound and look good. Without him, Tech News Weekly would not happen. And if it did happen, it would not sound as good as it does. And, you know, we've had some calls in the past that have had dropouts and stuff. So just imagine what it would be like if we didn't have Burke. Then the call would sound like somebody has a can of green beans up to their mouth and there's a piece of yarn running to the other one. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. So thank you, Burke, for making sure it doesn't sound like that. Until next time, where we will see you again, this has been and will continue to be Tech News Weekly. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye. And I guess I'll fist bump myself there.
Don't miss All About Android every week. We talk about the latest news, hardware, apps, and now all the developer-y goodness happening in the Android ecosystem. I'm Jason Howell, also joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and our newest co-host on the panel, Wen Tu Dao, who brings her developer chops. Really great stuff. We also invite people from all over the Android ecosystem to talk about this mobile platform we love so much. Join us every Tuesday, All About Android on twit.tv.